Thank you, choir. Wonderful. It's good to be with you this morning on a beautiful sunny morning. I had an entirely painless drive from the west side of Chicago this morning. Kind of unusual for my house. And I thought I really look forward to working with you next year, assuming that comes to pass. I'm hoping to be spending several months, if not much of the year, working with you on your social justice work here. And the idea is to help strengthen the good work that you're already doing, to build on the connections you're already making with other congregations and organizations and connect with others around the state, and to harness our collective power to create meaningful social change towards justice, beloved community, and a healthy planet. So I look forward to that, and again, it's great to be with you this morning. Last month, I was at the Carbondale Unitarian Fellowship, a thriving congregation of 150 members at the southern end of Illinois, or towards the southern end. Am I ringing too much here?
Yes.
The fellowship there had responded to the first executive order banning refugees and immigrants from 7 predominantly Muslim nations by reaching out and sending notes of solidarity and support to the 3 Islamic communities in town. The Sunday I was there, about 25 members of the Sufi Muslim community reached back by showing up at the Unitarian Fellowship for a forum where they shared about themselves and their faith, and they came to worship, where they brought greetings from their community. One of them shared an old Sufi tale about Mullah Nasruddin, who was invited to preach a sermon long ago. Mullah Nasruddin begins by standing up and asking the congregation, "Do you know what I'm going to say?" They all respond, "No, we don't." To which he replies, "Well, I have no desire to speak to people who don't even know what I'll be talking about." And he leaves. The people feel embarrassed, and so they invite him back again the next week. And this time when he asks the same question, "Do you know what I'm going to say?" They all answer, "Yes, we do." So Mullah Nasruddin says, "Well, since you already know what I'm going to say, I won't waste any more of your time." And he leaves again. Now the people are really perplexed. So they decide to try one more time. So they invite the Mullah to speak again the following week, and he asks the same question. "Do you know what I'm going to say?" This time the people are prepared, and half of them answer yes, and half of them answer no. To which he replies, "So now, let those of you who know turn to those who don't know and tell them what I'm going to say." And he leaves for the last time. It strikes me that what passes for our national conversation these days is something like this. We're having half conversations with those of us who think we know telling those who we don't think we don't know what we think needs to be said. There are many different competing narratives at play in these half conversations. Many people are saying that people aren't being heard, and that we need to get beyond our echo chambers. But some of us are saying it's white working class America and rural Americans who aren't being heard. Often the code words are everyday Americans or regular people. While others of us point out that this easily becomes a narrative that continues to exclude black and brown people and immigrants, people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender, people of diverse religions and different abilities, people who haven't been heard for generations, even centuries, because they have been seen as other and somehow not real, regular, everyday, normal people. Some people are saying we've lost our greatness, but that we can be great again if we just get back to the good old American values of self-reliance and personal responsibility, taking care of ourselves, protecting our borders and our freedom. While others of us are saying that greatness is about taking care of each other and our responsibilities to each other. Many people on all sides are saying pretty clearly that this is a war between us and them, and damned if it's going to be them, we need to win and they need to lose. The fundamental story we're telling each other is this: we're right and you're wrong. And while many of us are clear that this is what we are saying, we are right and they are wrong, we may not be as clear that those on the other side are not just ignoring the questions of right and wrong, but are just as convinced that they are right and that we are wrong. As an article I read recently puts it, people like us are seen as the enemy of America and American values, the enemy of what has made America great. And I had to stop and think about that one. What is my point in saying all this? I'm actually not suggesting that maybe they are right and we are wrong after all, that we just need to listen and see where they're right and we're wrong and get over it. My point is that the we're right and your wrong conversation misses a more fundamental truth, a greater story that needs to be told, and that is that we are all in this together. As Dr. King put it, we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. As our seventh UU principle puts it, we are all part of the interdependent web of existence. We are all part of something greater than ourselves, all of us. That may be the fundamental truth that our opponents are missing, but it's something that we can also miss ourselves sometimes in our commitment to win. And I don't mean to say again that the imperative for those of us who would stand on the side of love to win is any less imperative. The lives of marginalized people, the health of our democracy, the future of our very planet are all very much at stake. We do need to win. What I'm saying is this: the fundamental truth that I am committed to is that we are, they are, we all are part of something larger than ourselves. We are all in this together. And so my commitment to win doesn't mean that my side wins and the other side loses, but that everyone wins, not in terms of their political or moral agendas, but in terms of being humans, in terms of life. There is no version of winning in which excludes anyone as a human being that I believe in. There's no version of winning in which anyone loses as a human being that I or anyone else is bound to respect. So what does being committed to everyone winning look like? Part of it can look like turning to each other and listening to people of all races and backgrounds who have not been heard, and asking the question, how can we all win? And of course, we need to be clear that everyone winning may feel like a loss of privilege to some of us. But we also need to be clear that the loss of privilege need not mean loss of dignity and self-respect. We need to affirm and strengthen each other's sense of self as a non-negotiable given, independent of our material circumstances or our position in society or our political stance. I went to the protest at O'Hare Airport the night after the first executive order, and I was wearing my Black Lives Matter pin on my coat. A light-skinned policeman noticed it and said, "Hey, can I ask you something?" I said, "Sure." And he asked me, "Do I matter?" I was a bit taken aback by this. And I started to go into the whole thing about how black lives have been devalued for centuries compared to white people and especially police. And he actually didn't argue about that. He got that at some level. But then I realized he was asking a more fundamental question, not just about cops, but about him. Did I think he really mattered? And when I got that, I said, "Well, of course, absolutely, you matter 100%. Please go back and tell your buddies you all matter, not as blue lives, but as human beings." He asked me if I'd wear a Blue Lives Matter button. And if I'd had the presence of mind, I could have said, "Maybe I'll wear a Blue Lives Matter button if you wear a Black Lives Matter button on the police force." The political implications are more complicated, of course. But the point is that just as it shouldn't be a question whether black lives matter, it shouldn't be a question that anyone has to ask themselves, do I matter? Worth and dignity are a given in our value system. And the only way to make this real for people is not by reciting our first principle to them, but by affirming each other as real human beings in real conversations. The cop and I didn't finish any political debate in that airport. But hopefully, we at least started a meaningful human conversation with each other, which is one place where everyone winning could start. Everyone winning could also look like turning to each other and sharing not so much our opinions, but our stories of how we got to where we are, and asking others, "How did you get to where you are?" Being committed to everyone winning can look like turning to each other and maybe sharing the pain of what breaks our heart about the world around us, and listening to the pain of what breaks someone else's heart about the world around them, and perhaps even honoring the brokenness and the trauma and the sense of inadequacy that lies underneath so much of the pain and the anger and the hatred and the distorted humanity that we see breaking out among us in epidemic proportions, not just in Chicago or even Washington, D.C., or in Philadelphia or Kansas or St. Louis, I'm sure right here in Rockford as well. This epidemic of anger and fear and hatred and violence is nothing new. It is part of the legacy of our country, which has been there from the beginning, and to which we are sadly returning yet again. In an article about leaving America, Professor Jamila Karim points out that when people talk about leaving the U.S. after this election, it is because what they are seeing around them shocks them. This is not the America you've known. You don't recognize this America. For us in Black America, America has always been violent. This is the America we have known, the America we have grown up with. And this is perhaps part of another part of the larger story that needs to be told, that not only are we in this together, but we are in this brokenness together, and we have been for a very long time. The bigotry and the hatred and the violence we're seeing is not just a recent phenomenon, but something that goes back to the founding of our country and even before. The enslavement of African Americans, the extermination of Native peoples, the expropriation of other people's lands, the list could go on and on, right? And the violence continuing these days did not just affect some of us, whether it's a few bad politicians or a few bad gangsters or a few bad cops. It's something we are all caught up in as a society. I'll never forget the minister in East Chicago who responded to the police shooting of yet another unarmed Black man and the gang shooting of yet another innocent victim by pointing out that both forms of violence are rooted in dehumanization, the dehumanization we as a society have allowed and perhaps even engendered. The externalized dehumanization that says Black lives don't matter, and the internalized dehumanization that says my life and what I do doesn't really matter. The same could be said of the violence and bigotry we're seeing manifested these days. It's an externalized dehumanization of others, a diminishment of our capacity to believe that others actually matter, and an internalized diminishment of our own capacity to be human and to care, to believe that who we are and what we do actually matters as well. If we're all in this together, part of an interdependent web, an inescapable network of mutuality, we need to find ways to liberate each other from this dehumanization. We need to recognize that the oppression that dehumanizes people who have been marginalized is the same oppression that dehumanizes people of privilege. And whether it's classism or racism, sexism or ableism, homophobia or Islamophobia, or just plain selfishness, combined with the power to make other people suffer. These isms and the selfishness they manifest at personal, institutional, systemic levels, they diminish our humanity both individually and collectively. They diminish our greatness as part of something larger than ourselves. We all need to be liberated, individually and collectively, from the stories that says no one else matters, and the stories that say, I don't matter. The larger story we need to tell each other is that we are all part of something greater than ourselves. We are all in this together. Perhaps we can be liberated through this story because it tells us that we are each part of something greater. We are each part of each other, in fact. And that we all matter because we are part of this something greater. We may not be able to be fully human on our own, but we are enough together. And ultimately, none of us is alone. All of this brings me to the question I wrestle with these days, which is, how do we draw people who are caught up in the corrosive narratives all around us, the narratives that say we're all under threat, we need to put ourselves first, that others don't matter, that actually maybe we don't matter. How do we draw people caught up in that kind of confusion into a larger narrative that truly includes all of us? Cognitive scientist George Lakoff and social psychologist Jonathan Haidt suggest that perhaps we can begin to do this by tapping into the latent, hardwired tendencies in each of us to want to care for our own. We are not hardwired, and we actually do not vote primarily as individuals, but as tribal beings. We have evolved as a species to look out for those who will look out for us, family, tribe, community, which means that the story that we're all in this together is, to some extent, hardwired at that smaller in-group family level, tribal level. The challenge is to expand this in-group mentality into a larger tribal mentality, the extended tribe of nation, the extended tribe of humanity, the extended tribe of planet. Lakoff suggests that we do this through language, framing issues in terms of taking care of us, explicitly using and expanding the language of family and in-group to frame a larger we the people, rather than using us versus them language, which triggers different tendencies in all of us, the tendencies to fight and protect against those who threaten us in our in-group, against the them that threatens us. Lakoff even proposes a citizens' communication network of people trained in framing conversations in language that draws us into the mindset that we all take care of our own and that our own means all of us. Others like Van Jones and Parker Palmer and community organizers like myself, we talk about the importance of person-to-person conversations, listening to each other, connecting at a human level in ways that break through both the I'm on my own mentality and the us versus them mentality, building that sense that you and I, we are in this together. At a personal level, one conversation at a time. We can draw each other into the story that we're all in this together by sharing our stories and our brokenness with each other, and by listening to the stories and the brokenness of others. What might any of this look like in reality? I heard Senator Dick Durbin use this kind of in-group language when he began a recent speech by addressing the crowd as, not my fellow Americans, but my fellow immigrants. His words framed a wonderful narrative that we are all in this together as fellow immigrants. The marriage equality movement turned the tide of the cultural conversation around people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, through tens of thousands of person-to-person conversations, especially in places like Minnesota. Conversations which reframed the issue from an abstract conversation about a nameless other to a real conversation between people. About real people, about our sons and daughters, our aunts and uncles, our friends and neighbors, ourselves. People like us in our community and our families who are part of us and who are too often hurting. The woman who spoke up at Congressman Tom Cotton's town hall last month brought home the sense of family literally when she stood up and said that the Affordable Care Act had saved the lives of three members in her family, including herself. She made the brokenness in her life real, and it broke through the abstractions. It made this an issue not just about an issue, but about you and I, we, the people, and real families who are in this together. And these are life and death issues for some of us. My friend Rachel in Kentucky is creating the sense that we're in this together through her own personal listening campaign, talking to one person of an opposing political position each week, not to argue with them or even necessarily persuade them of anything, but to listen and to humanize the conversation, to create the story that we are in this together at a personal level, one conversation at a time. To create a culture in which we are all in this together, We need to learn how to stop talking past each other in these half conversations and start listening and start sharing. We need to learn how to tell a new story, a narrative that includes all of us, all of us. George Lakoff describes how the Conservative Leadership Institute trained 159,000 people over the last 20 years to tell a different story, a story of us versus them, which I suspect has been no small part in bringing us to where we are today. It may take some time, but imagine a citizens communications network of hundreds of thousands of people trained in the narrative that we are all in this together. Van Jones has 100,000 people signed up on his Love Army website, which is in part dedicated to just those conversations. An organization I've worked with called Landmark has quietly been training millions of people to powerfully create these kind of conversations through deep listening and deep sharing. UUs have many of the fundamental principles for these conversations with our inclusive principles and our understanding of covenantal community as about relationship. And we at my organization, UUNI, and we call it UUNI because it's about us together. We are working with an organization called Gamaliel to train 2,000 new leaders across the state in the art of person-to-person conversations to build that larger sense of we the people. I may run out of time here, but I'm going to share one more story about my friend named David. David grew up in a conservative fundamentalist household and was rejected by his parents when he came out as gay early in his life. The breaking point came when David went to a White House conference on families way back during the Carter administration, and his name ended up being in the lead paragraph in front page newspapers all around the country. David thought that was great, but he never considered the fact that not only would his parents wake up to a front page article publicly identifying their own son as gay, but that his parents would have to face all their conservative fundamentalist friends who would read the same article. David's father called him up and told him never to come home, and his mother didn't say anything. A few years later, David went through this Landmark training program, which I mentioned, which enabled him to get beyond the stuff in his head and the stuff in his heart and come to a place of deep peace and self-acceptance. He was able to get beyond others' rejection of him and see the goodness and truth of his own worth and dignity. He was also able to get beyond his parents' stuff and see that he didn't have to suffer from their rejection anymore. He actually became able to see the essential goodness of his parents' love for him, even despite and underneath all that rejection. And he even came to see the truth of the pain that he had caused them. So he called his parents up and asked if he could come talk to them. But he said that whatever their answer was, he loved them. They said yes. And when he got to their house, he sat in their living room and just listened to their Bible verses and their prayers and their anger and their grief for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours. At the end of 5 hours, he asked, "Is there anything else?" And his father just shook his head and then got up and embraced his son that he had rejected for so many years. A few years later, David's partner, the love of his life, died of AIDS, and he needed a place to take him to die, was dying of AIDS. He needed a place to take him to die because his partner's parents had rejected him long ago as well. So David drove his partner home to his own parents' house, and his once closed-minded father went out to the car and carried the frail body of his partner into the house. David's mother watched her son care for his partner for about a day before she asked for the number to David's partner's parents. She had not said anything to her own husband when he had banished their own son from their home. But now she called up these other parents and said, "Your son is in my house and he's dying. I think you need to be here." And they came. And two entire family systems were transformed because people were able to listen and hear each other. And a larger we was created among those two families. A son became able to listen to his parents, to love the pain and the anger, to love the literal hell out of them, and to bring them back to the goodness of their own love. Consider that just maybe it's going to take that kind of deep listening and conversation to change the culture of us versus them, which has reared its ugly head yet again. We can keep on having half conversations and talking past each other about who's right and who's wrong. We can approach our national brokenness through an us versus them paradigm and further feed the brokenness that threatens to tear us apart violently. Or we can start listening to each other and start sharing and start seeing each other as part of a larger we, a we that is broken, but a we that is in this brokenness together. And here's the beautiful thing. When we turn to each other and start listening and start sharing, we're no longer alone. The story that we're all in this together means that none of us is finally alone. None of us is outside. None of us is left out. Even in all our brokenness, we are all in this together. And perhaps even in admitting our brokenness lies the possibility, just the possibility, of redemption. Blessed be. I'm going to skip our final reading and move straight to the closing hymn, number 121. Please rise as you are able and bow your spirit to sing "We'll Build a Land," number 121. was going to ask you to join hands, but you've already done so. Thank you. You are. From the Sufi poet Hafiz, out of a great need, we are all holding hands and climbing. Not loving is a letting go. Listen, the terrain around here is much too dangerous for that.